Back in the saddle again. Regular crew is assembled. Reggie, producer, board op, checking the levels from the other room. Needles are bouncing. Talent is ready. Mics are hot. I think we're ready to do this. This is 199. I don't know what I'm going to do for next week with 200 guys. So we might just do a regular show. I don't know. I'm torn between trying to make an extravaganza and just saying happy 200th and let's move on and make no big deal about it. Like I said before, that Walter Payton thing of don't make a big deal about it. You've been in the end zone before. You're coming back again. 200 is 200. We're going to do 250 then, right? We're going to do 300. Who knows? So we'll see. But Reggie, I will let you know within the next couple of days, so you need to plan. But right now, we've got all our plans ready for this, so let's do it. Okay? Very good. Put it in the books, though, 199. And I do my three S's here, star, smile, and strong. And here we go. 3, 2, 1. Hey, it's Elton Jim Toronto, and this is Captain Podtastic. And welcome to another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted at WGNplus.com. Or this podcast is found wherever you go to download your favorite podcasts. If you go to another platform, don't forget to subscribe to that platform and rate said podcast. And most important, spread the word. Tell your friends. Send an email. Send a link. Make a post. Whatever it is you do to communicate with your friends, do that in the name of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Tell your friends and your fellow podcasting listeners that this is among your favorite, if not your favorite, podcast. We're always looking for more people to come into the tent. Your loyalty and devotion is much appreciated. And if you like what you hear, don't forget, on WGNplus.com, you go to the entertainment section, you hit the Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic prompt, and you will find all previous 198 episodes dating back to May of 2016, which can only mean one thing. Welcome to 199. Yes, we are approaching the 200 episode milestone. And as I've said in the last couple previous podcasts, I'm still debating if we make 200 a big deal or we just go on as if it's just one in the march to 1,000, right? I mean, if you do 1,000, then 200 was no big deal. So, I don't know. I'm kind of on the fence. But I have to make up my mind because the next podcast will be number 200. So I guess I'm just going to say you'll have to wait and see, right? But if you have been around for all 198 and you're around now for 199, I really do appreciate it. When I started doing this, I never expected to be doing it for this long and doing this many. I think I don't believe I've missed any weeks. I'd have to see if you do the 200 thing and you count how many weeks it's been since I started in May of 2016. I don't believe I've missed any weeks. I think it's been I've done, even when I've gone on vacation, I've I've pre-recorded some so that there would be no interruption in the listening process. So hopefully it's been 200 weeks. We'll have to go and get the calculator out and go find one of those calendar things and see how many weeks have been in the time period. I have to go back and get my daily planner. I always tell you how I keep my daily planners from past years, my hard copy daily planners, to see when exactly the first podcast was posted. I believe I recorded it sometime in mid-May, and so it may have been right around the 20th or something. I'll have to see exactly when it was posted. But anyway, we'll see what happens on that. I've got several days to make a decision. I wanted to talk a couple of things today. Later in the podcast, we will talk to Emily Arminetti. This COVID-19 virus is certainly taking the world by storm. Every day, a new story, a new cancellation, a new update. It really is becoming quite the epidemic, at very least. I don't know if it's a pandemic yet. We have to get the official definitions for these words now, but it certainly is becoming something to reckon with, whether it is legitimate in its severity or a lot of it is media-fueled and driven by panic and overreaction. We'll have to wait and see afterwards and sort of do a post-mortem on that and find out exactly was this as serious. But my goodness, we've seen the stock market crumble and concerns about the economy and major public events being canceled or postponed and schools closing, people working from home for extended periods of time, told not to come to work at all, even if you're healthy. So a lot of stuff going on, and I wanted to talk to Emily because where she lives has been impacted economically by this. She lives in Austin, Texas, as she's mentioned many times, and they had their South by Southwest event, big convention, a media-related convention, which has become a major deal for more than 30-some years and a major part of their economy. And they're in Austin's profile as kind of the hip, cool place to be. And one of the first major public events to be canceled a few weeks ago. So I wanted to get her insight as to what it's like to be on the ground floor of something like that. So we'll talk about that later in the podcast. But right now I wanted to talk about something that happened over the last week, which really caught my eye and which really got the hair on the back of my neck standing on end. I'm a huge fan of Woody Allen, the filmmaker, comedian. Have been for many years. I remember, seeing Annie Hall in the mid-70s as a teenager. And just at that point, a very young teenager, and I never even really, it changed my whole view on, movies and what was funny and my whole perspective. And Woody Allen's humor has certainly influenced me. Many, many comedians and funny people's senses of humor have influenced me, not only professionally, but personally, just my sense of humor. And so I've been a fan of Woody Allen's for decades. I know most of his movies, by heart. I have his comedy albums, read his books, the whole thing. Just major, major fan of Woody Allen's. Now, certainly, over the last, several years, Woody Allen has also become a controversial figure. About almost 30 years ago now, in the early 90s, he was accused by his former partner, Mia Farrow, and his adopted daughter, Dylan, who he adopted with Mia Farrow. They were in about a 12-year relationship together. In fact, some of the best movies that Woody Allen made in the 80s featured Mia Farrow in a variety of roles, both dramatic as well as comedic. He really wrote some amazing characters for her to show the breadth of her talents. And their relationship ended very acrimoniously, if you will, when Woody decided that he was in love with one of Mia Farrow's adopted daughters, Soon-Yi, which certainly made headlines. She was a young girl, 18 or 19 at the time, probably Woody was 50 or so, if not older. So it was a very just kind of tawdry situation here with Woody looking not too good. And everybody at first, you know, people still say, oh, he married his daughter. Well, really wasn't his daughter. He was never married to Mia Farrow. And this, you know, Soon-Yi was not his daughter. It was Mia Farrow's. I'm not condoning anything that went on here. I'm just stating the facts, just so you know the facts, because over the years, and especially in the media, things just, you know, people say things enough, it becomes truth. So I'm just stating the facts here. You can make up your own mind on Woody Allen, and that's part of what I want to talk about today. So allegations, so not only was there this this kind of torrid, you know, controversial love affair and ultimately marriage. And on the other side of the coin, say what you will, but Woody Allen and Soon-Yi are still married. They did get married and they're still married. So you can say this, you know, this was certainly a questionable ethical situation given her age and given her relationship and his relationship with Mia Farrow, right? So certainly some questionable decisions were made. But then you look at the other side and say, but 20-some years later, almost 30 years later, they are still together. And they are married and still together. So, you know, Woody's famous quote during this entire scandal, which was major deal, back in the early 90s, and was the headline-making stories, not only in the tabloids, like the National Enquirer and things like that, but on the national, I'm in the legitimate news media, especially in New York, where Woody Allen is basically, or was basically, an icon. He lived in New York. He was New York. He made his films in New York. He portrayed the city in many ways as a character. In fact, one of his films, and one of his best films, is called Manhattan. And he lovingly filmed the city. I had never been to New York until I was about 25 years old, 26 years old. But having been a fan of Woody Allen's from when I was a teenager, I was so enamored with New York that I couldn't wait to go there. Couldn't wait to go there. And when I got there and I went to many of the areas that I saw in Woody Allen movies, the place just came alive. And New York is one of my favorite cities in the world. And I go there as many times as I can. I love New York, like the tourism campaign in the 70s was. I do love New York. It's got its own vibe. It's got its own pace, and it is the center of the universe. And especially coming from Chicago, you know, those of us in Chicago, we're not supposed to like New York. We're supposed to hate New York because, you know, they're the other big city, even though now Chicago is the third city in terms of population. Los Angeles passed Chicago many years ago. It used to be New York, Chicago, and L.A. in terms of population. And now it's L.A., Chicago. And Chicago's actually getting, you know, losing some population to the point where Houston is, in Texas, is beginning to get close to be number three. But there's a huge chip on, Chicago has a huge chip on its shoulder against New York. You know, the whole idea of the second city, you know, became the name of the famous improv group here. But that was named Second City because that's kind of the way Chicago was billed nationally. And it became a little inferiority complex for the city. And so we have always had a written and unwritten grudge against New York. I don't have that grudge, even though I've lived in Chicago and the Chicago area my entire life. I am, I guess, one of those who say, you know, in New York is its own entity and it's a great place, and Chicago is a great place and has its own great things to celebrate. I always have been the mind of, from in the Chicago New York debate, you know, Chicago, you don't have to hate New York. You don't have to always say that, oh, our pizza's better, our this is better, our that is better. At the end of the day, New York is the center of the universe. It's the center of the media. It's the center, you know, the New York Times is kind of the newspaper of record in the country. It is where fashions and fads are created. I mean, it just is. And it's not only the center of the universe of the United States, it's the center of the universe of the world. It really is. So get over that, and as I said, and just celebrate your own special traits as a city, meaning Chicago. But the, you know, Chicago loves to do the comparisons. Don't compare yourself, because you really can't win. And the funny thing is, and that New York, this is how you know it's not even a race, because Chicago is always worried about New York and what New York's doing, and always comparing itself to New York. And if it can win some kind of a poll or something against New York, we always pound on our chest here in Chicago. But you always know that it's really not a race, because New York doesn't even know that Chicago's on the map. I don't mean that in a mean way. Chicago, New York just goes about its business. It's not worried about Chicago. But Chicago is always worried about New York. So anyway, Woody Allen, in many ways, for many people, for many years, came to personify New York. And so this story of Woody Allen's you know, marriage, you know, courting and then marriage to Sun Yi was major headlines in 1991 when the story broke. And then in 1992, interestingly, there were allegations put forth by Mia Farrow, now the scorned mother and partner in the Woody Sun Yi relationship. I mean, that, talk about heady stuff there, right? Your adopted daughter and your partner of 12 years get together. I'm sure that was that was quite the emotional and psychological jolt for Mia Farrow. And interestingly enough, some months after that story came to light, suddenly, allegations against Woody Allen purportedly sexually assaulting his adopted daughter with Mia Farrow, at the time a 7-year-old girl. Her name is Dylan. And so you can only imagine the headlines. The Woody Soon-Yi relationship certainly, you know, made people look twice at Woody Allen. Even his fans were like, well, this is kind of weird, right? But celebrities do get away with bad behavior. We've certainly seen that throughout the years and centuries. But then on the heels of that, then come even more serious and damning allegations about sexual molestation by Woody Allen against his adopted daughter with Mia Farrow. Well, you can only imagine what the headlines were screaming in New York and in the tabloids and all around the world. I mean, Woody Allen is not only a successful movie director and actor here in the United States, but he really is an international star. His films, most of the times, do more box office around the world in foreign countries than they do here in the United States. He is regarded as a genius around the world. So these stories and these allegations made international news. And coming on the heels of this first revelation that he was involved with Mia Farrow's daughter, was like, whoa. And so, now don't forget, this is pre-internet days, folks. This is 1992. I know for most people or some people, it's almost impossible to even comprehend what the world was like, or if there even was a world without the internet. But there was a time when there was no internet and there was no social media. And you basically had television and newspapers, which were dispensing your news, and radio and things like that. But, you know, traditional media. And this story was huge. I can only imagine how big and what would have been said in if this story would have broken, you know, 20 years later in the world of the internet and social media. Because it was a pretty big and scandalous story, even in the more traditional media world of the day. But to put it in a social media world, around the world, instantaneous opinions by everyone with a computer, oh my gosh, I can only imagine. And so Woody Allen's reputation certainly took a major hit. Now, he denied these charges of having any kind of inappropriate relations with Dylan. He categorically and vehemently denied this. And there have been stories. Now, she's a young woman now in her 20s. She still holds very hard and true to this story. Two separate investigations by two separate states and state's attorney's offices, because apparently, according to the story, when she came out and said this, it took place in Connecticut, and then later the New York state's attorney did an investigation. Two government investigations were done into these allegations, and both could not find credible evidence that it happened, and both state's attorney's offices in both Connecticut and in New York did not press charges against Woody Allen. Now, that's important to know. And there certainly were stories surrounding this, especially after he was not charged, despite all the scandalous stories and the shadow over him for a good year or so, as these were all playing out in the media. But there were some whispers and some allegations that a lot of this, of these charges, may have been manufactured by Mia Farrow in an effort to besmirch Woody Allen's reputation, because she was so upset and scorned by the original scandalous relationship that first broke about Woody Allen and Sun Yi. So it's a very complex, tawdry family issue that unfortunately played itself out in the media. One way or the other, if this is true and it did happen, to have this being a 7-year-old girl and now a girl in your 20s sort of have this play out in the media and then in the public is difficult and embarrassing. It's embarrassing for all people. All the allegations, all the truths and the non-truths, whatever they may be, this entire family issue with Woody Allen and Mia Farrow and their adopted kids. And they even have a natural child together, which plays into this story that broke this week. So it's a gnarled family tree. The roots of this family tree are very twisted and buried deep and gnarled. As I said, it's not a tree that has branches that just expand out straight. No, these. There's a lot of curling branches here and dead branches, sadly. And this all played out in the media. And the drumbeat has continued. And then then this sort of story went away. But then when the Me Too movement started with Harvey Weinstein and others several years ago, the Woody Allen allegations by his daughter resurfaced again. Not only by Dylan doing interviews in newspapers because of this idea of an older person taking advantage of a younger woman, in this case, a child. But then with the added power in the ensuing years of Dylan's brother, and Woody Allen's biological son, who is Ronan Farrow. Now you say, at first he was named Satchel when he was the natural son of Mia and Woody Allen. But after their breakup, he certainly sided with Mia Farrow and has completely disowned Woody Allen from his life and any kind of appearance of a relationship with him. He changed his name to Ronan. He uses Mia Farrow's last name. Woody Allen is not in his life at all. And Ronan Farrow has become a very fierce defender of his sister, Dylan. And as we know, Ronan Farrow has been at the forefront of this entire Me Too movement, having written some of the first stories about Harvey Weinstein and others, both in The New Yorker and then later in his own book. And so he has sort of become the face for the Me Too movement in terms of exposing some of these powerful men who reportedly have used their power over women in a sexual way, in sexual harassment and other ways. And so certainly with his high profile, the Woody Allen allegations of 20 years ago have resurfaced, and many people don't know the story, but when Ronan Farrow tells it from his standpoint, and now he has some new credibility, there's a lot of people that just automatically don't even go back and see what the story was. They just take his point of view, and he's certainly using that leverage. And I guess I don't blame him. He's been hurt by his father. He feels that his sister has been hurt. And he is defending her. That's fine. More power to him. But we also need to have facts here. And so those allegations cropped up about 2 or 3, 4 or 5 years ago. And now they've cropped up again because Woody Allen is now 84 years old. Woody Allen has had recent films pulled and not released here because of the Me Too connection. So there's definitely a line in the sand now drawn between Woody Allen you know, with in some people. You either love Woody Allen or you hate him. As I said, I can't justify some of his personal decisions, but I still can appreciate his talent and still enjoy his films. I'm of the mindset that you can appreciate someone's talent and not necessarily agree with what they've done in their personal lives. Because as we've seen down through history, many of the world's greatest artists have done and lived very unorthodox lives and made some very questionable personal decisions in their lives. And yet their art is unquestioned. And I am of that school. I can appreciate someone's art even if I don't think that they were the best person in the world or that I felt that they made some horrible decisions in their lives. I can still admire their art. And that's how I feel about Woody Allen. He was never a role model for me in any kind of personal way, but I just enjoyed his sense of humor and his films and his art. So that's where I stand on Woody Allen. And so he's 84 now. He's not making as many films as he used to. He's sort of still under this cloud, especially in this Me Too world. But apparently he had written an autobiography, had been selling it around for many years, and a publishing house had decided to publish it. And they just made an announcement a couple weeks ago that in April, Woody Allen's autobiography, written by himself, obviously, called Apropos of Nothing, would come out, you know, be published. Well, there was some immediate reaction, especially from Ronan Farrow, who now is a media star unto himself, who has some leverage, who has a lot of credibility with a lot of people. And ironically, the same publishing house who published Ronan's book about some of these sexual predators, a side publishing group, many publishers have small different sub-publishers publishing names under their umbrella, but the main company is there. Well, ironically, the company that was going to publish Woody Allen's book owned one of the publishing companies that published Ronan Farrow's. And, you know, he's in his 30s. He's got several books probably left in him for the next 30 or 40 years, right? So he leveraged that and basically said, if you publish this book by Woody Allen, then I can no longer work with you because you're hurting me and you're hurting my sister. Because he still holds fast that her allegations against Woody Allen are true, despite Woody Allen being cleared by two investigations. When these happened, it doesn't matter. He still stands by his sister, which, as I said before, is his right. But Woody Allen, I guess, you know, still has a right to go on and do what he wants to do, right? So this publishing group bought the book and was ready to publish it. Well, when the news broke, especially in New York, and especially among younger people who may not know the history, there was great uproar, especially at the publishing house, by many of the people who work there, male and female. And many of the employees staged a walkout saying, if you publish this book, this Woody Allen book, they walked out and they had a big problem with it. And initially, the publishing house, you know, said, well, we're going to look into this. We certainly don't want to create a hostile environment for our employees, blah, blah, blah. But within a day or two, they shockingly announced that they were not going to publish the book. And I have to say that really rubbed me the wrong way. Because in my view, they are practicing censorship. It is not, they already decided to publish this book. And because some people at their office were offended. And maybe they are young people, maybe they are young women who have a sensitivity to the Me Too movement, and I appreciate that. But I don't know if they have all the facts, because this event with Woody Allen and Dylan was alleged long before they were even born, or they were babies and didn't even know it was happening. And they're coming at it 25 years later, and I don't know how much of the facts they have, how much their emotions are driving them, but they stage this walkout, and it seems to me that the publisher, rather than standing up for what it was initially that they bought the book, and standing up for the rights of freedom of speech, and let the public decide on this book. But to stop and pull the publication, which they initially agreed to, because some workers at their office protested, seems to me that that's censorship. And really what they're doing is they're succumbing to blackmail. Because basically Ronan Farrow is using his credibility and his leverage to say, if you publish this book, you're going to lose me. So now they're looking at it from a business decision and probably saying, well, let's see. Woody Allen's 84 years old. He's not going to write any more books. Ronan Farrow is 30. He's the hot guy right now. He's this crusading writer and reporter. And he probably has 30 or 40 more years of books in him. And so if we want to stay in the Ronan Farrow business, then we're probably going to, you know, what do we have to lose by cutting Woody Allen loose? He's not going to write any more books for us. And once again, not sure how much behind the scenes, you know, Mia Farrow has a lot of people in her camp, a lot of powerful people, you know, in publishing and in the media on her side on this. Who knows if she allegedly, reportedly could still be pulling some strings when it comes to Woody Allen. She was severely hurt by his actions with Sun Yi. And you never know how long that grudge may continue, and what she has told Dylan and what she has told Ronan. They're listening to her side of the story, certainly not Woody's. And so it really angers me to see that once again, the court of public opinion is driving these decisions in this very murky Me Too world. We seem to overlook some people's indiscretions and allegations and attack vehemently others. Those who we like and respect, we somehow let those go away. And those that we don't like, we hammer until they are ostracized. And I don't like that. If we're going to do something, then it needs to be uniform. If this act is wrong, it's wrong by whoever does it, whether they are beloved or whether they are hated. But we are not dispensing due process and equal justice right now. We are letting the court of public opinion and who we like as a society, or who powerful people within the society like and who they don't. Recently, Chris Matthews from MSNBC was forced to resign over some comments that he allegedly made to a woman. At the same time, on NBC, which owns MSNBC, longtime respected anchorman Tom Brokaw had some allegations made against him. But some reason, Tom Brokaw is still on NBC. He comes on and talks about elections, and he is given this utmost respect by all his panelists. Why? If the allegations are out there, Why does Tom Brokaw get a pass from the same company that Chris Matthews didn't? That's my point. Same allegations. Different people. We respect and like one, and the other is kind of polarizing, so it's easy to get rid of them. That's not right. If the deed is wrong, it's wrong for everybody. Not just some people that we like culturally and dislike. It's for all. So this Woody Allen book, I don't know if it would have been good, bad, or not, but it wasn't. The publisher agreed to do it amidst the Me Too movement, amidst the cloud that has hung over Woody Allen the last couple of years. They still decided to publish the book. But then some disgruntled workers, who apparently could not be replaced, that's another thing. You know, if you were the publishing company, I would say you have every right to protest our publishing of this book. We support your right to protest. Good for you. You're standing up for what you believe in. But you're fired. They had every right to do that. And I'm sure in New York, there are thousands of people that would kill for a job, especially younger people, at a major publishing house where New York is the home of publishing, pretty much. People would die to get in into a major publishing house and get a job there. But instead, they succumbed to blackmail by Ronan Farrow and by their employees. The employees had every right to walk out, every right to register their complaints, but the company had every right to hold fast by its initial decision and either say, we respect your right to disagree. If you feel that you can't work here, then we accept your resignation. But we're publishing this book. And if you don't like it, you can either leave or we'll ask you to leave. That's the way it should have been handled. But instead, they backed down to Ronan Farrow's threats and blackmail. And they succumbed to their employees' dissatisfaction with their decision. Not happy with that. We've got to have equal justice and due process for all. I'd like to read that book, and I hope there is some publisher out there that doesn't support censorship, that doesn't succumb to blackmail, and has the guts to publish that book. And if they do, I hope it's a big hit. And now we take a stroll over to the Pop Culture Club with Emily Arminetti. Hello, Emily.
Hey, Jim.
So, I wanted to talk to you today about something that is close to home in more ways than one. I have not really spoke too much about the coronavirus here on the podcast because I was hoping it would just go away.
Yeah, right? Don't we all?
But apparently it's sticking around for at least a couple more months. Hopefully it goes away when... I really hoped that once the coronavirus had heard that we had changed the clocks... and we were now in meteorological spring, that it would realize that the winter was over, flu is rarely in the winter, and go away. But that's apparently, right. It gave itself another hour to spread.
Right.
Oh, no, actually, we lost an hour, right?
We did, yeah, we did.
Yeah,
we
lost so it's hour. Actually spreading, it's making up for that hour.
Right.
It's spreading faster since we changed the clocks. But... but anyway, one of the first major casualties of the coronavirus in terms of public gatherings, and here in Chicago, we have had some major conventions that have been canceled over the last couple of weeks, which, according to estimates, hundreds of thousands of hotel rooms have been Now, you know, reservations are canceled. You know, tens of millions of dollars lost in the Chicago economy, and who knows how more is going to happen. But one of the first events that was a casualty to the coronavirus in terms of bringing people together was right in your hometown of Austin, the hipster gathering called South by Southwest.
Yes.
So South now, by. Were you... Now, yeah, what do you call it over there?
We South like by? To refer to it as South by.
South by.
For short.
Yeah.
I know that winds you up.
Now, what does... now? So now, just so everybody gets... because this, you know, for those of us who know what South by was, I was like, wow, that's a big deal. Now, initially, there was some major... it's basically an entertainment kind of cultural gathering. It started as kind of a hipster kind of political musical thing.
Well, it started as a music festival.
Yeah, but, like 30 some years ago.
Over the course of, I mean, it's been going for 34 years.
Yeah.
And so today, South by Southwest is huge. It spans music, film, and there's also like a whole tech convention associated with it. So like, if you can imagine, a couple thousand music events, then you have a few hundred usually film-related events, which include like presentations and panels and stuff like that. And then think about it like this. Think about like a more traditional tech trade show type thing happening at the same time, and all of it happening here in Austin.
Yeah, I mean, what's so funny is I remember in the mid-80s, because you said 34 years ago, so it was the mid-80s, I was just getting my career started, and I had a music column in one of the local suburban paper, you know, chains here. And I remember getting this pamphlet sent to me because I was a music writer. And it said, hey, you know, now don't forget, in 1986, you know, Austin, Texas was not even on the map. I mean, nobody even knew that it existed. It was not the hipster haven that it is now.
Right.
So there's this pamphlet that says, hey, you know, this new underground, you know, music. Because that was the buzzword back in the 80s. Underground made it sound like it was cool. And it said this new, you know, music festival in Austin, Texas, and they, you know, offered me to come down. You know, they didn't pay. They weren't going to pay, but they're say, hey, you know, come down. We got these cool, you know, alternative groups. It was a very kind of, as I said, underground, very cool and hip for the time. You know, but it was a fledgling thing. I mean, who knows how many even people they had it. And then I just,
right.
And I remember as time, I would get these for about for the first 5 or 6 years, you know.
Yeah.
And it was, you could always see that every year it seemed like, you know, the bands they were getting were a little more prominent. And you could see this thing kind of growing. And then suddenly in the 90s, it really took hold. And then I would say in the 2000s, when, to your point about technology, you know, as the internet started to get more popular, and then so technology started to show up. And then a lot of, in the last 10 years, a lot of the major movie studios would come and introduce and give, you know, previews to some of their more, you know, cartoon or comic book or superhero or you know, cool new movies that were coming out, to where the point was this was almost like a Comic-Con now, where major people like Apple and the major studios and the major tech firms, as well as high-profile music acts, came for what? How long does that usually last?
These days it goes for like 10 days.
Yeah. I mean, that's a major, it's, you know, so apparently, I guess about a month or so ago, some of the major media companies like Apple and Warner Studios were concerned, and they said, we're not coming. And it sounds like once some of those major people said they weren't coming, then the festival people decided that it just wouldn't be worth.
Well, I also think it just became clear because the situation changes daily. And I think that initially they said we're still having it. But I just think like in a very short amount of time, as the situation globally changed, I do think that they decided the right thing to do for like public health and safety was to cancel it.
I really do think, though, that they were a major. But the fact that, you know, that they were one of the first, you know, big you know, conventions, whatever you want to call it, you know, public gatherings about a month or so ago to cancel. I think that really they were kind of a forerunner to say, okay, this is getting serious and we do have health concerns. And I, you know, I'm not saying good or bad, but they may have paved the way for more people to take a step back and say, wait a minute, should we continue with our big event?
Right. Yeah. Yeah, because I think, you know, I mean, you can't underestimate, like, you know, it's scary to think about people getting together in these large gatherings. And when you think about the influx of people to Austin, I mean, I've seen estimates about, I mean, I have a sense of how big South by Southwest is because I've been to an event or two. But, you know, I've read that, you know, over 150,000 people attend the various events here. And so, and many of those people are coming in from outside of Austin.
All around the world.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, this is something on that scale. I think they really needed to think about it. And especially because, again, the situation with coronavirus has been changing hourly, daily, you know, and the guidance changes every day. You know, every day we see something new that, the, you know, the CDC is giving us guidance on. So, you know, I mean, it's a real shame, though, because it's a massive hit to local businesses.
Yeah. So have they given any kind of estimates as to, I mean, I would assume, because I remember when they canceled it, I think the mayor of Austin, you know, was saying that this is a major economic, once again, because it was at the forefront of the cancellation of these things. You know, now we are certainly seeing the economic, you know, hit that overall the stock market is taking and individual cities that have these big events. Were there any initial numbers of what, like did they ever say what that usually brings into the local economy?
I don't know if they know yet what the full impact will be, but I did read somewhere that, like a couple years ago, I might have been in 2017 or 2018 figure that, South by Southwest brought like $300 million.
Yeah, I mean that's.
I don't know how accurate that is, but and again, I don't think they even have a sense yet of what the true impact will be. But I do know that on the one hand, well, first of all, the mayor of Austin has declared a declaration of emergency, and I wonder whether he had to do that to help the organizers.
Oh, right.
Then maybe that needed to be the trigger for any kind of like insurance clause. I don't know. But even then I read that it's not clear whether that the insurance that covers, you know, the organizers like for the event doesn't necessarily cover, like, I don't know if this falls under act of God type thing. Like, you know, it would insure against various other calamities, you know, but that's unclear right now based on like the latest stuff that I've seen in the news here. You know, I know that the parent company that runs and organizes South by Southwest has already laid off a third of their workforce.
Really?
Wow. Yes. But I mean, there is a local nonprofit I just saw in the news yesterday that is like, this is what they do there. And so they've stepped in to try to help place some of those people in new jobs. And they also are trying to help local businesses to try to avoid layoffs as a result of this. But this is a nonprofit that kind of, that's what they do. They have various services to help.
Yeah. When that happened, was that kind of a wake up call? I mean, even now, as you said, which is correct, how the you know, this on a daily basis, this coronavirus is a fluid story, and there's new things popping up every day.
Yeah.
But because South by Southwest, you know, was one of the first events to be canceled in the country, and it does have such an impact, because while Austin is a very attractive and hipster place to live, it's not a huge city.
Yeah.
And so something like this, which, you know, brings attention to the city, is a great kind of, you know, tourism boost and economic boost. So, I mean, what was kind of the feeling in the city? I mean, while there were health concerns, was there kind at that point, since it was kind of early in the reactions to the corona, what were people's initial reactions when they did cancel it?
Well, I think the reaction was like, wow, okay, if South By is canceled, this is like real. This is, and not that people didn't think it was real, but you have to remember too, like, we haven't had I'm going to touch wood. Tell me if you can hear that. We've not yet had any confirmed cases of coronavirus in the Austin area. And I haven't really heard of any closer than maybe even San Antonio. And in San Antonio, I think those may have been people who were brought to a military base from elsewhere, if you see what I'm saying. So, like,
yeah.
Really, we're watching this and we're following it on the news here in Austin, but it's not something that really has hit us locally yet. And I think canceling South by Southwest, people recognize, like, that is a really big deal. And a lot of thought went into that. And I think especially because in the initial response was, the festival will go on as planned. And then that changed so quickly.
Yeah.
You know, so I definitely think it's something that people, I also think though that locally people do realize like it was the right thing to do. And then now the sense is, what does this mean for local businesses? Because the thing is like, you know, and you see in the local news, like, of course, you know, this is like they're interviewing business owners, freelancers, people who, you know, this, they count on this to support their business. And like the general sense is like, look, my business can be kind of feast or famine. And South by Southwest is the feast that helps me get through the famine times during the rest of the year. And so the reality is without that anchor, like it's very possible that people will go out of business. I mean, I've even read that there are fears that like, you know, it's sort of one thing, the economic blow of like a one-time cancellation of South by Southwest, but like it's not even that. It's like it's a whole other situation if the event has to go out of business altogether. Because again, the organizers have already had to lay off a third of their staff. Now, they have said that badge holders, they're not refunding money for badges, and nor do they have to, because my understanding is when you buy a badge for South by Southwest, it is right there, not even in the fine print, right. In the large print, no refunds for any reason.
Right.
But they have said that those badges will be honored at the next South by Southwest. The question is,
will there be one?
Well, so this is the thing. And so that remains to be seen because it's a matter of, how do they go on? Now, like I said, you know, there are organizations. There is this local nonprofit organization that made it very clear on the news that they are trying to work with the organizers to try to put those people in new jobs and also help give them like some guidance and support to not have to have any further layoffs. And so that's promising. You know, hearing that made me feel a little
better. So when they first made that announcement in a town like Austin, where this South by Southwest event is such a big deal and basically takes over the city for almost 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Then did that, after that announcement was made, did the city then hunker down? Were there more, all of a sudden, was there more awareness and more concerns about other things in terms of working from home and schools and other public events? Did that sort of trigger then a domino effect within the city?
I mean, we've definitely seen since then more communication. Like I have two kids in two different schools, and both schools have sent out mass communications explaining to parents like what they're doing in terms of like sanitizing the schools and how they're following CDC guidance. And just keeping us generally updated. They've also sent out guidance about things like travel, because of course spring break is coming up. One of our schools is asking for any families who are traveling outside of the country to self-quarantine for 14 days after they get back. Now, my and that's not a public school, so, you know, let's just put that out there. But we've also seen, I mean, I've definitely heard, like, through the grapevine about, from other families, like people who for work are being allowed to work from home. Some of the larger organizations here, my understanding is, have their staffs all working from home for the time being, at least until after, like, again, spring break in Austin technically starts on Saturday. And so I think they're maybe using that as a little to kind of, you know, have a little time and space from this and have people home, or not, at least not coming to offices anyway. But I've heard that some offices are letting people and telling people to work from home for the next couple of weeks. So we'll see. I mean, whether or not that was triggered by the South by Southwest cancellation,
yeah,
who's to say? But certainly that was like the first real official like ramification that we felt in Austin.
So as a parent and, you know, of, you know, two young kids, so ultimate overall, now, as you said, this is a very fluid situation. And for instance, to your point, to what you just said, my wife's business, they, you know, where she works, just yesterday, they declared everybody has to work from home. Not everybody, but certain different, you know, certain you know, departments,
yeah,
are working from home and from now until the end of the month.
Yeah. I know there's also been a lot of travel bans. Like companies now are saying they don't want anyone traveling.
So how do you feel? So how do you feel about with your kids going to school? Are you worried? I mean, where do you stand on this? Even and from your own, you know, personal thing about travel. I mean, mm-hmm. where's your head right now in a coronavirus world?
I mean, I think I'm trying to keep calm. I just think it's inevitable. I mean, it's not in Austin yet, but it's coming, you know? I mean, it's coming. There's no doubt about that. I think that, you know, with travel plans and stuff like that, like, at the moment, I'm just following the guidance I'm hearing on the news, which is, like, continue to live your life, you know? You don't need to start hoarding stuff. You don't need to cancel travel plans.
Why are people hoarding? Why are they hoarding?
That is a great question.
Toilet paper. Is there some shortage of Charmin that I'm not aware of?
Listen, the toilet paper thing, I don't know. I guess our greatest fear is that we will end up on the toilet with nothing to use. I don't know.
Yeah,
but I'll tell you this. It's so funny. Even before the toilet paper had disappeared off the shelves, I was just doing my normal Monday morning kind of shop after I got the kids off to school. And it was like, this was just at the brink. Like, this was when, like, coronavirus, like, was happening, but, like, stuff was not selling out yet. And I was there, and there was, like, an Instacart guy. You know what Instacart is?
Yeah.
Like, when they go and they shop for people, right?
Yeah.
There's, like, an Instacart guy. They wear the little badges. So you know this guy's not shopping for himself. But he has a cart that has – I'm like, are you – dude, you're shopping for, like, a doomsday prepper. I mean, there were, like, 30 boxes of – you know, penne pasta and like 30 jars of marinara. Well, it was just so weird to me. So there's that. The other thing that I think is weird is, like, I understand the rush to, like, make sure you've got some hand sanitizer, but, like, do we need to hoard hand sanitizer? Because, like, I have, like, a regular size bottle of hand sanitizer on my nightstand that honestly, like, that could last 2 years if just using just normally.
Right,
like, you don't need 30 bottles of hand sanitizer.
Well, look, I mean, look. Sadly, in the human species, fear and panic is cooked into the DNA.
Yeah.
You know, from our molecule, from our beginnings as cells and molecules, we were afraid of being eaten.
Yeah,
and we were afraid of dying. And so that is in our, and so when the cavemen came about, once again, they were afraid of getting eaten by a lion or getting killed by another one of their own tribe, you know, of another tribe. So fear is in our, we will always panic first. Now, our problem as a society and a culture is that we panic and we overreact.
Yeah.
And then when the fear or the apparent danger subsides, which it usually does, then we could become complacent to the fact that we don't even remember what happened, which then opens the door for it to happen again. Because we completely then, we go on to the next shiny object, and we forget, and then we get so complacent, and then you have people, you know, leaving their doors open in their cars, and they say, well, geez, why did my car get stolen? I never thought it could happen here. You know, but 3 months later, when there was a crime wave in their neighborhood, then they were all worried. But then when the crime wave stopped, they went right back to their old way of doing things.
Right.
And then their car gets stolen, and they can't understand why. And it's the same thing here. We will always panic first, sadly, and we will always overreact. And I think that there's certainly, and as I'm speaking, you know, in the middle of March, who knows what will happen, you know, by the time this podcast is posted. But, you know, and like you said, it's such a fluid story. But
yeah, fast forward to 3 months from now when Elton Jim's sitting in his house with no toilet paper, no food, no water.
Well, like I said, I'm right now in a, you know, I don't want to wring my hands because it might be, you know, not healthy. But, I mean, I'm supposed to see 3 more Elton John concerts between now and April 7th, which will total my number 200th show in New York. And as it stands right now, I don't know if those are going to happen.
I know. I'm telling you, you need to prepare. Because of the time frame.
Like, I know.
I feel like that's still too close. Like,
yeah.
Like everything else, this hopefully will eventually resolve, because we did the same. We went through the same panic with SARS. We had the Ebola thing. When I was pregnant with James, swine flu was the thing.
Right.
I remember that very well because I was in a vulnerable, quote
right,
unquote,
right,
you know, like group. So,
You seen that one email? There's been one posting on Facebook at least. They've shown from 2000 to 2019, and it said there's every year. There was a major health scare of something from the past that was supposed to kill us all.
Yeah.
And, you know, it starts with 2000 with Y2K.
Right, yes.
The world was supposed to end. And then, to your point, there was swine flu on there. There was Ebola. There was SARS. And so every year we have always had some kind of, you know, potential health crisis that, you know, everybody became Chicken Little. Everybody, the sky is falling. There's no question that the internet and social media and 24-hour news cycles have elevated the panic and the concern. I think there's no question that you should be concerned. And like you said, you should go about doing some, you know, some extra precautions.
Yeah, wash your hands. You know,
I don't think
I'm definitely much better about forcing my kids every time we enter the house. I'm like, straight to the sink, wash your hands before you eat, wash your hands. Not like, I mean, that's normally stuff that you would do, but like some days, you know, when it's more chaotic than others, you kind of forget to like buckle down and say like, hey, all right, get over here and wash your hands. But so now, you know, people need to do that. Try not to touch your face, which is really hard. Maybe we all need to start wearing those dog comb things.
I tell you, you don't realize how much you touch your face.
I know.
You
I do
touch
it so much.
Your face. I just did it 5 minutes ago. I went, what am I doing?
I know. I rub my eyes a lot.
I know. I just did that. That's what I just did. That's just what I just did.
So that's what they need to start manufacturing, human cones.
Well, right? you know what's so funny, though? Now, here's the thing. This is my point about, you know, getting overreactive and then getting complacent. So what's interesting now is, in the face of this corona, we are being reminded of basic good hygiene.
I know.
That we should be doing all the time.
All the time. And I'm a real big hand washer, which is why my hands are always chapped. So you can imagine I probably won't have any skin left on my hands after.
But I think that's so funny is that basically what they are telling us to do is what we were taught when we were 5.
Right. Like, stop being gross. Wash
your hands. Yeah. And yet we as soon as we hit a certain age, all those things that we were taught about the right way to do things, for some reason, we just abandon them all, and we get in this. So what's going to be interesting to see is 4 months from now, hopefully when this subsides or goes away, will we still be cleaning our hands? Will that reaction to touching your face, like you're just saying, trigger you to say, whoa, stop that? Or will we just fall back into our old, bad, horrible, hygienic you know, traits or behaviors that in some ways may have actually caused this?
Well, it's interesting that you should say that, because I just saw on the Today Show this morning, you know, of course, they have the medical experts every morning, like, kicking off the show to talk about this. But today they were answering some questions. And ultimately, what the medical expert was saying is, it will be interesting to see whether once we kind of come out of this, it'll be interesting to see whether, because now then if we all become really indoctrinated into really good hygiene,
right,
this will help us for next season.
That's what I'm saying. I mean,
right, when it starts in the fall,
because that's the I think what, from what I've seen of some of the experts from the CDC is that there is a hope, like most flus, that this will sort of burn out and die out on its own, hopefully, as the weather gets warmer. And so what they're really looking at is, will it make a reoccurrence again in the late fall or early winter, where then all of a sudden they have to realize, okay, this may be now a recurring flu that we have to start to guard against in terms of vaccines and changes of behaviors, but hopefully there'll be a vaccine just like there is with the regular flu. So, you know, that's where, you know, the future is looking. I think the experts are hoping that, like most flus, this one will die out, and like most of these other viruses that had their, you know, these big, you know, percolations, and all of a sudden they just kind of died out. So that's the hope. But there's no question that this is really taken hold of the world, and now we're seeing, you know, parades and concerts and conventions and schools all canceled. I don't know, you know, you sort of take a step back and say, are we overreacting, or is too much, is over concern a good thing in terms of spreading? Like you said, is there a certain point though where you have to live your life?
But there's a lot of concern, but at the same time, it doesn't seem to be stopping it from spreading. So I don't really know. I mean, it's tough to say, because like, then you have these, you know, these cases that you hear about anecdotally where like, there was a woman, this was in San Antonio, actually. I heard there was a woman who they thought she maybe had coronavirus. She was being tested for it. She was in quarantine. Two tests came back negative. So she leaves. And of course, where's the first place she goes?
Right.
To the mall. Right? Of course, she goes to the mall. Then, after she goes to the mall, they get a third test, comes back positive, which they weren't expecting. So now, they call her and tell her, you got to come back into quarantine. And then she's like, oh, okay. So then it's like, and where have you been? Well, I was at the mall. Oh my gosh. Okay, fine. Alert, alert. Then you have some guy in Utah who I read had come in contact with someone, maybe. Before he knew this, he went to a BYU game, right? Okay, so now he's in a big stadium. So it's kind of like, there is concern, but yet there doesn't seem to be, even among people who have, and I get it. If I was tested and they said to me, we've tested you twice, it's come back negative twice, you can go, you are free to go. Would my first place be the mall? No, I mean, I would be happy just to go to my house, right, and be like, great, I'm not stuck on a military base anymore. So I don't know. But then again, or would I just be like, well, I was tested twice, so I don't have it. You know, it's hard to say. So, you know, we just have to see. And then I think obviously there are these kind of like places that have surges of it, which clearly like they're shutting down, like Italy is totally shut down. You know, even New Rochelle, New York, which is like, wow, I would have thought Manhattan would be the major hot zone. But, you know, it's just like, I think everyone just kind of has to keep using common sense and keep following the guidance. But at the same time, like, if they're telling us, keep living your life, like, keep sending your kids to school, you know, then I feel, touch wood, but I feel like I feel okay with that. Because honestly, they're saying at the end of this, 70% of people will actually end up getting it. And 80% of those people, is what I heard this morning, will basically have mild symptoms.
Right.
So
I
worry the most about people who are most vulnerable in our communities. And that's really what I'm personally worried about right now.
Well, all I can say is hopefully we can talk to you soon. Hopefully you won't be quarantined.
Well, even if I'm quarantined, I'll still have my phone.
That's true.
It'll be covered with germs. But that's okay.
And keep Pirelling, and please, by all means, buy toilet paper.
Listen, hey, I have only my normal supply.
I know, so do I. Paper. I don't know what. I mean, I'm still it. Of the, I didn't know there was a, like I said, I didn't know there was a shortage on paper plates and towel and paper towels.
This is the other thing too. Like the experts were saying that The problem with hoarding when there are panic situations like this is that it's a self-fulfilled prophecy. People start hoarding for no reason, and then they create a shortage.
Of course. Well, I'm just going to go by the Seinfeld rule. I'm just going to use a square.
This is the thing. When you get to the point where you're going to your neighbors and they're like, sorry, I can't spare a square.
I can't spare a square. I'm going to use...
We're in real...
I'm going to try. It's going to be very difficult, but I'm going to try for the two square wipe.
Yeah. Can't spare a square.
Can't spare a square. And hopefully we'll get through that. Well, so Emily, thank you so much for giving us some Austin insights. I'm sorry that South By, if you will.
South By, yeah.
But hopefully next year you guys will reclaim your hipster cred.
Yes,
and have an even better South By.
That's right.
Can I just say one thing? South By strong.
That's right.
That's right.
I like it. I'm gonna try to get that to catch on here.
That's not bad. I just saw that right now, but I think that's pretty good.
Yeah,
I like South By strong.
I will help you try to get it catch on locally.
I like that. We'll talk to you soon. Thanks, Emily.
All right, thanks, Jim.
And so ends another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted at WGNplus.com. Or this podcast is available at any platform where you find your favorite podcast. Don't forget to subscribe and rate. And most of all, pass on good news and good word about this podcast. Send a link, send a message. Send your good tidings that your favorite podcast is Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Hope you enjoyed episode 191. I'm Jim Tirano. I'm here on business. I'm only here for fun. And you have been listening to Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, from the end of the web to your screen.